Hey everybody, this is Perry Marshall. Welcome to a very unusual webinar. This is not our usual marketing, get more customers, make more money, bag more clients deal. This is a lot deeper than that, I would say. And so I have a guest with me, Jess Smiley. And actually, if you give me a second, I will show you. Got a couple pictures we're going to show here, so you should be able to see Jess in this picture here of her and her family. And Jess is a good friend of me and Laura and my kids. They used to live just down the road from us, and she has quite an interesting story. It's a sad story. It's a happy story. It's a very rich story. And yeah, you know, this is kind of an unusual topic, but it's Christmas, and you know, not everybody feels happy, joy in Christmas, right?
Right.
So, Jess, welcome.
Thank you.
So, so I don't actually remember when I first met Jess, but what I do remember is that she and her kids and my kids went on a little trip. I think it was Kansas City, and when they came back, Alex had some kind of bruises or marks on his back or something like that, and that was a bad sign. And then this whole crazy story begins. So you can start there. You can rewind way back before then. How do we – where do we start, Jess?
Where do we start? We can start there. Yeah, we – moved to Chicago and lived here for probably just about a year when Alex started getting sick. And we recognized some of the signs because I had been through this previously with my first husband. And so when he showed up with bruises, we kind of didn't really know a whole lot what to do with that. We just sort of left it and just was kind of on alert. And then he got a cough, a really dry cough, and had a mark on his ankle that looked a lot like ringworm. So that was my sign, like, okay, I'm not dealing with fungus. We'll go to the doctor. And quickly found out that it was leukemia through a bunch of tests and having no immune system. So he was instantly invited into his long stay into the hospital. And we started our journey there. So he, I'll back up and say the story of my husband, my first husband, Jamie. We moved to Australia to do some missionary work, and we were there for about 4 months, and he had really vague signs of the disease as well. And I won't go into all that because, you know, you can research leukemia if you want, but he just was getting sick and not doing well, and was also diagnosed with leukemia, and he only lived about 5 months after he was diagnosed. And it was pretty traumatic. It was a shock. We were really young. I was 28 and had three little kids, the older three that you see in the photo.
Wow.
Sam that was the youngest. He was just two. Alex was seven, and Haley was five at the time. So, we moved there to work in a church, and we're just into Australia. Yeah, so we lived on the most easterly point of Australia, and Byron Bay, New South Wales, and we were just really getting a start, kind of getting a hold of, like, okay, this is what we want to be when we grow up. Mm-hmm. And we had three little kids, and just sort of finding our way. And Jimmy wasn't feeling good, and he went to get checked out by a doctor, and when they said it was leukemia, we honestly had to ask if that meant cancer. It was such a weird thing to be told, and the goal was to get him into remission so that we could come back to the States, and that just didn't happen, and so he died while we were there, and I had 2 weeks to leave the country because I was in violation of my religious worker's visa, so I got kicked out.
Wow.
Had to come home. I went back to Indiana, which is where we came from, and with the three kids, and just kind of took a year to sit and figure out, you know, what to do, and went through a lot of grieving, a lot of sadness, and a lot of putting my stuff on a shelf because I had three little kids who were sad. So life became about figuring out how to journey through that grief in a healthy way. Grief actually started for us the moment Daddy didn't come home from the hospital. So we had a bit of practice before he actually died. And so I got remarried while living in Indiana, and we moved to Chicago because that's where my husband lived. And so we had a year under our belt of figuring out how to be a blended family and redo it when Alex got sick. So it was a real blow to the heart when he got sick, obviously because, you know, you don't want your kids to get sick, but even more so because it felt like, okay, we already did this. Aren't we exempt from pain and suffering because we already did it?
Wow.
And no, we weren't. So it was an in-depth struggle because we already knew the effects of leukemia, and we already knew the outcome, and we already knew the percentages. And then we had to fight for someone else as though we didn't know any of that stuff.
Mm.
As though it was like, okay, you have just as much chance of survival as everyone else. And he made it through a bone marrow transplant. Sam, the little one, was the bone marrow donor. And he went into remission and came home and was good for a year and then showed signs of relapse. And we really dug deep. We went, I mean, not only like medically, but we went even to a church that we were familiar with having miracle stories in California, and went there and had people pray for him. We sat with our panel of doctors at the hospital and talked over every option, and he wanted to fight, and we were believing in healing, and he got that it was a more of an eternal healing, and he only lived 3 months. Yeah, 3 months after he relapsed. He just had a full organ system shut down, and mostly due to toxicity of medicine. And no one ever told us that we didn't have an option. So with my husband, I was really on the cusp of learning all about natural health and trying to go a different route with medicine. So by the time Alex got sick, I was full-fledged into holistic healing and health. And I wasn't going to do chemo with my baby, and we didn't have an option. No, because legally, under the age of 18, you don't get a choice. If they have a certain life percentage, you are legally bound.
Really?
Yes. So we didn't get the option.
Wait, now there's all this stuff that I even forgot or didn't know. Wow.
Yeah.
So against your will, you had to put him in chemo.
Right. And, you know, and so that's, and I only mention that to say as part of the grieving process, that's stuff that comes up because, you know, you go against things and, you know, I say it's my intuition to not go that route. I don't know that he would have had a different outcome, but it's really hard. It feels like you're fighting from behind when you're going along with something that you're not fully endorsing.
Yeah.
I fully believe that chemo has the power to eradicate cancer. However, like our personal beliefs is that it's not about eradication of a disease. It's about what are you saving the person to? Mm. And if you're destroying the quality of life in the process, I wasn't fully sure that I was on board with all of that. So I felt like I was dealing with a lot of personal stuff underneath it all, on top of here's this wicked disease and the disease process and how the treatment goes. So, you know, I bring that up because when, you know, we're talking about when Christmas makes you sad or when, you know, dealing with sadness and grief, that's some of the underlying stuff that comes up. It's the inside stuff that doesn't get said, that doesn't get talked about, that keeps you awake in the middle of the night. You know, when you see a person, it wasn't both with my husband and my son, neither one of them were a case of, here they were here 1 minute and they were gone the next. Disease gave us the ability and the time to say, okay, it's better for this person to go on. So the actual death part, you know, we were all pretty much for the most part okay with. It's all the other stuff that gets sad, you know, what if we would have done this differently, or what if it would have been this or whatever, and that's sort of the trap, the cycle that you go through with undoing, you know, the grief.
But you had a lot of people pulling for you, too. I mean, this was a you know, major focus of attention for at least 100 people, right?
Yeah, we had a huge support system. And, you know, I don't think we could have done it, actually, without it. I mean, even 100 people of the people we knew, and then hundreds of people we didn't know, you know, that would sign in on our Caring Bridge page for the hospital, or check in, or words of encouragement through someone else, you know, people just knowing the fact that we were on other people's minds and in their hearts, and people praying for us.
So you lost Jamie, and you immediately had to, you know, switch into survival mode to just, you know. So then all this happens with Alex. I mean, wasn't there stuff that you hadn't even sorted out from the first round that no?
Right. Yeah. It. You know, I was naive, and I sort of thought I did. You know. I was remarried, I was kind of getting a new life, and we were going on with creating a new normal, and, you know, I mean, I was sad, but I felt like, okay, I'm not really dealing with stuff anymore, you know, and then Alex got sick, and I found myself in the same mode. I call it my mean hospital self, because I wasn't the nicest person in the hospital. I find that when I am in survival mode, I'm not very nice. So,
Mother Bear with her cubs.
Yeah, just about like that. So I was growling at everyone, and, you know, and I knew that stuff was coming up to the surface, but in the way that I knew how to deal with things at that time, that wasn't the time. And so I was in the mode of always putting my own stuff on the shelf and just kind of getting through the practical things.
So, sorry here. I'm just gonna make sure that if people, somebody's probably gonna ask a couple of questions here. So, you know, if people have questions, they can type them in, and we may eventually get to at least some of them. But you know, just mention that. So, all right. So, you know, mean Mama Bear in the hospital. And I think you're suggesting that was just an indication that you weren't really done sorting out even from the first round, right?
Right. Well, no. I mean, it was fear. I was so afraid. There was so much stuff that was coming up, you know. And the stuff that you reconcile, you know, that I reconciled, I didn't think I would have to deal with again. So, for me, the final part of grieving my husband was, okay, you know, it was nothing else I could do. He was just gone. So, okay. And I kind of just left it at that. I wasn't thinking that anyone else was going to leave. Yeah. You know, I thought, okay, we did it. We went through a really, really hard thing. That was our big moment of pain and suffering. And I kind of just filed it away unknowingly that I would have to have, you know, a stronger source to refer to.
Okay. Well, so talk to me about that. You know, what stronger source? You know, I think a lot of people, they kind of hunker down, they go to church, they pray. You know, you mentioned taking Alex to get prayed for. You know, there's, let's just say there's some churches where a whole lot more healings happens than others. Mm-hmm. I can personally attest to that. So, tell us about, you know, that whole side of the story.
Yeah. We've been part of churches that operate and that healing is for now, you know, and they will pray for miracles really under the idea that, you know, more people get healed when we pray than when we don't, you know, just simplify it and to quote many pastors.
Yes.
So, you know, we thought we'd try that. You know, we personally believe that is very possible and does happen. And we know people who have been healed. And so our faith was right there. I will say that my faith was also right there when Jamie was sick. And I assumed that because we were living in a place that was predominantly non-Christian, that God would just use this as a whole testimony, and he would heal him in the 11th hour at the last moment, and he would get this great big victory.
And you'd go on the speaking circuit, of course.
Yeah. You know, God doesn't really need that from us. He doesn't. He actually doesn't need that miracle to beef up his, chest and his ego. He doesn't quite have that issue that we do. So that didn't happen, and I spent a while trying to figure out, okay, where is God in all of this? Like, if, you know, his job is to make himself look really good, you know, and that comes through healing, and we get the benefit of being healed, but it really is for his glory and recognition. And it really wasn't about that. I found a really quiet place with God after Jamie died, and that sort of became my center. And it's really hard to explain. It didn't actually even deepen until Alex got sick, but God started this place deep in my heart. Mm. You know, in the Bible, as well as other holy scriptures and other religions, there's this idea of being still to know. In the Bible, he says, "Be still and know that I am God." You know, in other references, it's just "be still and know." And that was a lesson that I was being taught, that for as much frantic running around that was happening, nothing was really getting accomplished. All the talking, it was great because I got to process or retell my story over and over and over again, of which I'm sure has changed to what actually happened, because we tend to not remember things as accurate as we think we do. Right. You know, and but when I'm quiet and I'm still, all of a sudden everything made, you know, it makes sense, and I don't have to have words to articulate it. It was just a piece that would come along. So that has sort of been my compass heading, and when Alex got sick, that is a place that I could go to and know, okay, I have to go to that source, which for me comes from God, you know. And so we instinctively went back and said, okay, well, we're still going to pray for healing, because more people get healed when you pray than when they don't. Yeah. But it came with a sense of peace that it's actually going to be okay, regardless of the outcome. So it's like healing is not dependent on your circumstances.
Explain that more. That, it sounds like there's a lot more. Can you unpack it?
Mm-hmm. So, when we think of healing, we expect to see a result, mainly in the physical capacity. We understand the energetic of the heart, because we know that when we talk about our heart, we're not just talking about the physical muscle that's beating, but also the energetic side of the heart, the things, the space inside of us where we hold the essence of who we are. And so we even can go to that level and say that healing, you know, we're also looking for healing in that capacity. But there's a greater healing, which is actually just an unveiling of our wholeness. You know, we're created to be whole. And we are already everything that we need to be. There isn't this place that's like, oh, well, I'm broken, and so I need all of, you know, X, Y, and Z to happen to make me whole. You're already whole. And it's an uncovering. And so for us to reach out and ask for healing, of course we were asking for the physical healing, but what was happening, and I can't speak for Alex, you know, because he's not here and he's gone on, but for me processing this as a mother and as a wife, what happened was, in my own journey of healing and asking for healing, and asking for healing was just getting back to that place of wholeness, of realizing that, okay, I want this boy to be completely whole in whatever capacity that looks like. You know, if it's going to happen physically, that's what I want, you know, because he was 11 when he was diagnosed. He had a long time to live according to what we think life should last on this earth.
Right.
And, but the thing that happened was that as we, you know, people were praying and, you know, and I am talking sort of out of both sides of my mouth, because there's that side of me that just wanted that plain day, like, just fix it, you know, just get rid of the cancer, just get fixed, and let him be, you know, the quote, normal little boy. But the other side was that he's special. He had, like, a huge call on his life that people recognized and saw, and I can say this now that I think that's just part of his journey, you know, and that he was able to go through an experience that everything is as it should be. It's all part of it. I don't say that lightly because I understand that for me to say that brings up issues for people that say, no, that's actually really unfair and he died too soon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't see any good coming out of cancer and I don't see that God has anything to do with any of this, you know. And so I just want to speak to that because I feel like coming through the journey that I've been through and being able to say that doesn't mean that I wasn't in that place where I said, you know, why do bad things happen to good people? Were we not good? Were we, did something happen? Is this, you know, punishment? Is it karma? Is it whatever you want to label it? Like, why? Mm-hmm. Why? What I learned is that why wasn't the right question to ask.
Okay. What is the right question to ask?
What do I do in light of what's happened? What do I do with this? Where there's a treasure in every moment, every single moment. So where is it in this?
Even the sucky stuff.
Even the sucky stuff. It doesn't matter. So there's a treasure in every moment. What is it? What's happening? What's going on? So you can't stop any of it. You know, leukemia is not a cause and effect disease. So there's not like, well, we did X, so now we get Y. Like, it just happened. There's not enough evidence out there to show anything concrete right now. So
it isn't leukemia like...
Well, it's just a malfunction of the bone marrow. So when your body is making these blood cells, they're supposed to grow up and become something. So these little baby cells are supposed to become red blood cells or white blood cells or platelets. And so what happens with leukemia is that the bone marrow is just shelling out these baby cells. They don't really have time to figure out what they want to be when they grow up. So they're being leaked into the body and they're essentially worthless. They're not doing anything. Mm-hmm. And so it really is one of those things where we can say, okay, this was not their fault. Like, it's not Jamie's fault that he got cancer. It's not Alex's fault that he got cancer. So it caused me to say, okay, wait, then we don't get to blame something, you know? We can't even really blame the disease. It's irrelevant. It just happened. So in light of it just happening, what can come out of this? We can't undo it. We're trying. I mean, we didn't sit there and take it and say, okay, well, it's cancer. Oh, well, see you on the other side. I mean, simultaneously while fighting this fight is also becomes the search of, okay, so what's going on here? You know, Jamie would say over and over again in the hospital, like, we get to participate in this suffering. Like, we get to be part of it. So I learned early on that this joy that's promised in the morning, you know, we have this dark night and there's joy that's promised in the morning. But if you can dive to the depths of that sadness, that's a greater understanding to the ecstasy of the joy that's coming in the morning. Like, you get to get both sides. Mm-hmm. You don't really actually understand joy if you've never known sorrow. And people who know that, they get it, you know, that you get it, you appreciate it, you know it. It becomes real to you. Mm-hmm. And so I got to just experience both sides of that and see. And so when I started asking for healing with Alex, I already had this understanding of, you know, I'm not just about eradicating the disease. Like, I want to. This is first our priority. But I actually really wanted wholeness for this child, for this boy, for whatever it is that his life was unfolding to be. And so not so much why did he get cancer, but what do we do with this? This is now the path that his life has taken. Mm. So what do we do? where we just need direction, we just need clarity and what to do and where to find the treasure, how to find it.
So Paul has a question. How much time did you spend in prayer before, during, after? Did you change the way you prayed? Did you ever get angry at God? Did you blame God? Some days too busy to pray.
Yes.
Pick one.
All of it. Okay, I'll just kind of run through them. So how much time did I spend in prayer before, during, and after? I would say I had a pretty regular prayer life beforehand. It was, I didn't really know, you know, what I was praying for in general. A lot of times it's just kind of conversing with God, sometimes praying for other people, behalf of issues or whatever. And I have been a worship leader for a long time, so a lot of my prayer comes in the form of just worshiping and honoring God and who He is to me. So that was sort of my prayer life. During my prayer, sort of morphed and changed into more like, oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God. That was about it. Help every once in a while. After, it was like, seriously? This is it? This is what you are? Really? Okay. And so did I get angry? Of course. Yeah. It would be foolish to say that I didn't. I was actually in one of my journaling posts, I told God off and said, you know, I feel like I'm stuck in a marriage with you. I know enough to know that I am in this with you. I don't like you anymore, and I don't want to be in it anymore, but I'm stuck. I don't want to go to hell, because isn't that the option, to not be in right standings with God, right? So this is where I was. I don't actually believe that anymore, but that's where I was at the time. And so I said, I'm stuck. I'm stuck in this marriage with you. I don't want to be in it. So yes, I have been angry with God, and frustrated. I think those are two different things. It's,
how about a separation or maybe alimony or something?
Yeah, seriously. I mean, like, what on earth? Like, why do we need to do this thing anymore? Clearly it's not working. Like, you're taking people away. They're gone. Now I'm here. It's like a divorce, really. Like, he gets the kids, right? So, yeah. So we have words, God and I. I'm fully convinced that in His grace and in His heart and His sense of humor that He still loves me and that we're good. You know, it's real. It's raw. It's real. So my pain is real.
How do you know this? Which I think is a fair question, because, you know, 10 or 15 years ago for me, I think I would have said, for my experience of God was more of a theological proposition than an experience. But that has certainly changed for me, and I have a feeling that's also changed for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How is God more than, what does it mean to experience God?
Well, He's not a religion.
Okay.
To me. So it's, He really became alive to me well before I knew anything about cancer or anything. It would be a great story to say that was my awakening moment, but it really wasn't. It just, I had a long-standing relationship from childhood, really. I grew up Catholic, was very close to the idea of the person of God through Jesus. All of that was really real to me. As a teenager, I came into the, quote, personal relationship with God, for whatever that means to a lot of people. To me, it was just an invitation to start talking to Him as though He were my invisible friend, but I got to have Him well outside of the years that I would have outgrown the invisible friend. So that was sort of who God was to me. You know, and growing into that in my later teenage years, I just began to have experiences of the reality of who He was, just feeling things outside of what I could make up for myself, you know, kind of those invisible arms coming around me and bringing comfort, guiding me on stupid teenager road trips that I shouldn't have been taking, and all of a sudden I was safe. And, you know, testing God in the area of tithing in my early 20s and giving away money and watching it come back to me in the exact amount that I had heard it would, you know. And so I started having little experiences here and there. You know, I want to be old hippie at heart. I really was like outside of that time, but I wanted to be a deadhead really bad, and was
that's a whole
found yeah that's story, a whole actually. That's a whole another chit chat.
You can go a little on that rabbit trail if you want.
Well, you know, we just experimented with a lot of that lifestyle, and what I loved about it. And I'll just pick the points that relate to who I am now so that you can kind of get a little gist of this crazy person you're listening to. But what I loved about it was that there was this essence of peace that flowed through the people, through all these hippies, and the love that people extended one to another. And the first time I ever met gypsies, they stole something from me because I was in need. And it was just like, whoa, wait, you're bending all the rules, but you're getting to the heart of an issue.
Wait,
you know?
I don't understand.
So I was in need of things. You know, I didn't have physical things that I needed at the time. And so they would steal them.
Oh, not from you.
No, not from me, for me. So I was provided with like a blanket, a sweatshirt, extracurricular activities, all stolen on my behalf. But what I took away from that was that, okay, wait, you are getting to the heart of a person without putting that boundary up and saying, oh, well, it has to look just like this inside of this box. They created a whole new outside of the box lifestyle that I was really attracted to. And, you know, I'm not endorsing the lifestyle, but I'm just saying what I gleaned from that was this ability to be a lover. And I wanted to love people like that. And I thought with everything that I grew up knowing about God, if you coupled that with the hippies, that would just be heaven. Oh, my goodness. If, like, you took their attitude towards peace and love and generosity and paired it with what I knew the heart of God to be. Because that wasn't my experience inside of the church. Growing up, it was very like, this is what you do. You go to church and you're here to serve God. Then outside, I saw this whole thing where it was like God became alive, and it was just an entity that was just filling the atmosphere, and that's really what I was drawn to. So, so I kind of took that on because, you know, we all create our own image of God, and that becomes our religion. And so I had that image of God. That's the image, that sort of lover and the kindness of God and all these things that I found that I could biblically back up. His heart became the one that I really was drawn to towards worship and everything else. And when Jamie got sick, I spent a lot of time with that God, and then I didn't understand. And all of a sudden, like, I thought, well, maybe he's not really like that. Maybe he really is like the judgmental person, and there's been sin in our lives, or we've done something wrong, you know. And even though I didn't believe it really, like, I still questioned all of that. I still was going through, you know, all the normal things of like, I don't know, I'm not really sold on all this, you know, so much. And then after Jamie died, and I found that quiet spot, it was the kindness of God that spoke to me and really just wooed me and put a salve around my heart and helped me heal. And, you know, and I guess I can only speak to experience because that's what's so powerful. When you have an experience of something, whether it's good or bad, or it leads you in a good direction or a poor direction, that really becomes your staple for life. You know, people have an experience of eating a food they really like, then they're inclined to cook it, they want to share it with other people, you know, and so forth. So it really was my experience of God in the way that I knew him that was so powerful for me. And but I will say that I dropped religion as a whole and just started pursuing the person of God. I just really wanted to know, okay, who is this, and what is this journey about?
Okay, so my experience of this was, so we went to the same church, Greater Chicago Church in Oak Park, and it's a pretty, I don't know how you describe it. It's a place where people have very high expectations of God showing up.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, some of you might have seen the miracles page that I sent out in one of the emails, coffeehousetheology.com/miracles, and it's kind of a chronicle of all these different things that I've seen and experienced. And, most of that started, with GCC. And so, all right, so everybody's like, oh, man, we're going to do battle, and we're going to pray for Alex, and, and it was this pretty valiant effort, and round one went okay, and then, round two was a knockout, the wrong kind of knockout, at least, and, everybody's kind of dazed and bruised and sad, and we went to Alex's funeral, and you had a couple of pints of vodka to help you along, and it was pretty rough.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
I can't speak to the stuff that was going on at church so much. I had that experience both with Jamie and Alex that I've noticed other people's experience of your people dying is quite different, because while everyone was having a service and praying while I really appreciate that, our stance was, bedside, and my time with God was face down on the bathroom floor in the ICU room, and very lonely, and
yeah.
Even though it's encouraging to know that people are sort of by your side, the physical aspect of it is, Sam and I, my husband and I, we were alone, and it was scary, and it was really rough. And when Alex died, it was immense sadness. It was just really overwhelming. And again, there's this physical thing that just sort of shut off. Like, okay, he's gone. I've got, two little kids. Like, we were in Milwaukee where Alex is being treated. So we had to move out of the place that we were staying. And so it's a lot of, for me, doing the practical stuff has always been my coping mechanism. Like, okay, we've got to get packed up. We've got to get back. We have to do this funeral. I think having so many people show up for the funerals and supporting us gave me the ability to sort of let go. And our pastor and friend, Ian, gave me the option at the moment that the thing was going to happen. And if you can't do it and you want to back out, or you just want to do it by yourself and have something, anything was up for grabs. And I really, really cherished that, because that's what I needed. I needed to know that I actually had options. And I didn't know that I needed to know that, but as soon as I heard it, it was okay. And I thought, okay, I can do this then, and we can all do this together, and we can go through it, and it can be this really raw time, and I don't have to be... I can be undone in front of these people. This is my family. And yeah, I drank for his funeral a lot, actually. And it was tequila, not vodka.
Oh, sorry.
But
fix that on the way.
Yes. And it was good. I didn't need it, but it was good. It was, I've never really been much of a drinker. And so it was good. It was good. It just kind of allowed me to be a little human, and just be like, hey, this sucks. I don't have anything else to say. I can't say anything that's going to fix it. And right now it's just sad. And I think that was really empowering, to give space and time for it to just be sad.
So tell us about the next few months after that.
Yeah. So it was that for a long time. It was really hard. Alex died right before holidays, you know, so we had a month, and then it was Thanksgiving, and then Christmas, and I just didn't want to do any of it. It was hard. So we stayed with people who kind of kept us engaged in life, you know. We had some friends and my sister and her family for Thanksgiving, and you know, we rearranged furniture and did some practical stuff of going through Alex's things. And for Christmas, we stayed with my mom's family, and went to Florida and just kind of had a vacation to just let it go. And it was just really putting it on the shelf. I took a break from going to church. I just needed some solitude. And you know, and then under the guidance of people who loved us, we gradually came back into the scene. Probably, you know, within a month and a half or so after, 2 months after it happened. And I was just spent, you know, I was done. I had, you know, been crying. You know, we were really just real with that whole time. The grief was hard, and we went through some counseling, and I was in a place finally in January where I was ready to say, okay, whatever it is. You know, you get to a place of desperation where you're so over what you're feeling and what life is doing that you're actually willing to do whatever it takes to get better. And so for me, that came in the package of just kind of letting it all go and being like, okay, I'm done. I'm done hanging on to it and doing it my way. And, you know, my journey with God was in the place where I was like, whatever it is that you want to do here, do it. Cause I don't want to do it anymore. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm totally clueless. The older I get, I'm not even old. I just feel old in my mind and in my life experience. But the further I get along in life, the more I realize, like, I don't really know. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't have the answers. So I'm just going to let it go. And I just want it to be whatever it's supposed to be. So do your thing. and I didn't say that with any sort of like lovely resolve, as in, God, you're all knowing, and you know. It was really a sarcastic, like, you're gonna do whatever you want anyway, so just do it. Like, I'm done. So I should change my tone of voice to match my intention, because I don't want to mislead anyone and think that I was really in this like kind and lovely fluffy place of, you know, whatever, God, you just do your thing. It was really whatever, go ahead and do it. But out of that came this really letting go. And I was able to just release this thing that I had been hanging on to, this pain and the disappointment, the really, really deep disappointment that comes with, whoa, life just hit us upside the head and it did not go in the way we thought it was going to go. Okay, we built a new life, and then the floor got ripped out underneath again before I even had firm footing in this new life. And so there is a ton of disappointment, and willing to let go of the disappointment and say, okay, you know, I'm not even going to hang on to that. I'm just going to let it all go. Whatever letting it go looks like, I'm just not going to hang on to it.
Well, but would now be a good time to talk about the Toronto trip?
Yeah, because that was the first thing that happened to me after this letting go notion.
So I have to explain Toronto a little bit, and then you can go on with the story. So I want to rewind back to, it was like probably 94 or 95. Laura and I went to Willow Creek, which is one of the biggest churches in the country, in the northwest suburbs of Chicago. And it's really an amazing place. They kind of reinvented church about 30 years ago. And a lot of things that are kind of new, different, and modern in church today came from Willow Creek. And while we went there, Peter Jennings, the guy from ABC, came and did a segment on Willow Creek, and he did this whole I don't remember if it was 2020 or if it was some special show, but it was like Religion in America. And they featured three churches. And I don't remember what the third one, but the first one, one of them was Willow Creek. And they explained, like, Willow had this whole approach. You could almost think of it like they kind of had the Starbucks approach to church. And that probably... I don't know. That might not sound funny to some people, but I mean, they really had done a lot of things ingeniously well. And so he did a segment on that, and I thought he did a pretty good job. And another one of the segments was on this other church called Toronto Airport Christian Fellowship, which is, I think, in Etobicoke, Ontario, if I'm not mistaken. And the pastor there is a guy named John Arnott. Well, the thing that they showed on the TV show was this thing called the Toronto Blessing, which was all these people rolling around on the floor laughing. It was like the craziest thing you ever saw, okay? And the, you know, the journalists were, They certainly were less snarky than they could have been. But, you know, I don't know. You can't really present that on TV without kind of making fun of it, right? Now, I remember, looking back, I remember just kind of suspending judgment on whatever it was that was going on there. Like, why are these thousands of people laughing, and what does this mean? And I just, you know, I remember when I was 9. Now, I grew up in this church in Nebraska that was extremely conservative, and they weren't having any of this miracle stuff. And they had this musician come, and he played. And while he was playing, he told this story of this kind of deliverance thing that happened with his mother once. And they were so offended at him telling this story that they told him that he was never invited back. And I remember my dad, you know, telling me about this. And my dad was simpatico with the decision, I think. And I remember thinking, well, how do you know that wasn't real? Like, this is his own mother. I mean, he's not an idiot. And so for some reason, I managed to always kind of suspend judgment on this kind of stuff. Well, fast forward, and I go to a different church, and it's a completely different stream of Christianity, and I come to find out that, well, you know, I can't speak for, you know, the next faith healer that you happen to see on TV. I'm not going to make any bets on that one way or the other. But I'll tell you, I've seen people be healed. I've seen it happen right in front of my eyes multiple times. And you know, I mentioned a website where... And so I'd never been to this place. And so you and me and about a dozen of our friends get in a van and we go up there.
Right.
And there we are, at the same place that I saw on TV 15 years ago, okay? And, well, it's like just got the laughter.
Yeah.
So that's the Perry version of what happened, but I want to hear your version.
Yeah. It's funny. I'm not much of a giggler, actually, or wasn't, but for a whole church full of people who knew me for that short amount of time, that's all I did for a while. So when we went there, it was shortly after I had come to this, I'm finished, I'm done, this letting go time. And I went completely open-minded with, I didn't have any expectations. I actually was a last-minute add-on to the trip. I wasn't even planning on going. I wasn't engaged in church activity at that time. I had, you know, sort of taken a leave. And I just decided at the last moment to tag along, so I didn't have any expectations as to what was going to happen or what I was personally going to get out of it at all. I was really just going to get away for a couple days. I love to travel. They said they were going. I thought, okay, cool road trip. It's the hippie nomad wanderer.
Yeah, I remember we're sitting in a Wendy's in Buffalo, New York, and we're just like cutting jokes, and I'm sitting there thinking, boy, I'm glad Jess can like not be serious for a day, right? I mean, it was like being in high school.
Yeah, it really was. It was a total like fun trip, you know. After going through months of really dark stuff, it was nice. It was really lightweight. So, you know, we get there and there's great teaching. Actually, some of it is a little bit of a blur, you know. Luckily, I was taking notes so I could remember, like, the content of stuff. But really, I remember the thing that happened was I just felt warm and, like, safe. And, you know, the environment there is really conducive to healing because that's what they focus on. That's what they spend their time and energy on. So they cultivate this place that feels really inviting and really safe, and
it's very unpretentious.
Yeah, it's very unpretentious. You know, people are weird, and that's okay. You know, I had a pastor one time that says, if you're weird and God touches you, weird is what's going to come out, you know? And so, and it's okay, though. I mean, it was like, it really is like the Christian version of a dead show. It's like the whole mass of people, everybody's doing their own thing, nobody's judging, nobody cares, and, you know, and what's nice is that there isn't anybody walking around going, well, I don't know if this is real or not. It doesn't matter. So the fact that it doesn't matter gives way to let whatever happen. So
I gotta interject, but there's another church that's kind of, you know, a spinoff of the Toronto church that's also in Ontario, and I went there once. And a guy came in with, like, it was like a 5-foot-long stuffed tiger. And he put it on the floor in the corner while worship was going on. And he laid down with his head on his tiger. And he took a nap. But, like, this is how hippie this place was.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, and it really is like, from my perspective, it's just whatever. People are sorting out their own journey. So, you know, I don't know. Yeah, all judgments aside, it's fine. It is what it is. So we were there and, you know, people would do these altar calls for just being prayed for and just really being touched by God for whatever that looks like. And when, you know, when people pray for you, sometimes you can cry. I mean, there's a ton of emotional reactions that happen. And, you know, and I'm quite familiar with that route of Christianity. So I was totally fine to just let whatever happen. But I started to giggle. And then I didn't stop, and that was really weird because it's not like I was out of it. There was a part of my brain that's like, okay, I'm still laughing. Oh, honestly, it's probably been like 10 minutes. Well, 13 hours later, I finally calmed down. I mean, this is like I'm giggling on the floor with friends. I mean, you were there.
Yeah,
you saw. We were all giggling and laughing. But then everybody else is getting up, and it's, oh, okay, time to break for lunch. Well, I'm not breaking for lunch because I'm still giggling and I'm still laughing. And then we come back and it's session in the afternoon and everyone's still, you know, doing their thing. And I'm just on the floor just giggling, there's nothing even going through my mind. It's just pure giggles. There's no psychosomatics happening. There's no, like, deep inner healing where there's this conversation happening and God's going, okay, now we're going to do this, and I'm going, okay, and nothing. I'm just laughing. It's just funny. There's not anything in particular that's funny. And then we go for dinner, and luckily I had some friends who were like, okay, you have to at least get up and eat or come with us or something. I laugh all the way through dinner and back to the church, still laughing, still giggling at night when it's time to go to bed, rehashing the day with everybody, and I just, you know, but as weird as it sounds just to say, okay, hey, you know, whatever, that's really weird, the powerful thing was that I really laughed away the sorrow, and it was gone. It was gone. And it was an experience like I had never had before, and I've actually never had that since. It was unique to that specific time, and it was exactly what I needed. Mm. And I have had a lot of times of sadness since then. So it's not to say that there's this magic spell that's been put over me and I am the giggle girl and now I don't ever get sad.
Right.
Sadness is very real, and it's okay. It's okay to be sad. It's also okay to not be sad. It's also okay to be completely healed, and healing can happen instantaneous if you're open to it. I think the prerequisite for me was the letting go. And I'll just be willing to let it look like whatever it's going to look like. We let go, still our minds are engaged and we think we know what's going to happen next. I really expected, okay, well, if God's going to do this healing thing in me, you know, it's very serious, right? Cancer is very serious. Death is very serious. The healing must be very serious. And it wasn't. It seemed so purposeless. And there was nothing to it. I mean, and I got home and my kids said, Mom, you look different. Your laugh is different. Things were just really different. And for a season, I had whole lightheartedness, and it was pure, and it was raw, and it was just as every real as the sadness was. And then...
I saw this. Yeah. I mean, look, I've seen people get the giggles. I mean, we all know what that is. This was something completely different. I had never witnessed anything like this. And so, like, just to give some perspective, like, my cousin Chris was killed in an accident 15 years ago or something like that, and my aunt and uncle have had this just kind of devastating grief ever since. Okay. And it's just this, like, savage, awful thing. Okay. And, you know, and you see, you know, especially when people lose kids, I mean, you mm-hmm. see this happen, and it's like, and I'm watching this all over again, and now Jess is in the middle of it. And then, you know, this laughter and joy thing happens, and you know, like, I'm seeing this with my own eyes while we're on this trip. And then we came home, and the other thing that stands out in my mind was, so we get to church the following Sunday, and Ian says, hey, you know, anybody that wants to get up and talk about what happened to you while you're on the Toronto trip, you know, come up and talk. And so some people come up, and they're like, they're telling these stories. And Jess gets up, and she's saying, yeah, 3 months ago, my son died of leukemia. And then she's doubling over laughing. Like, this was the most impossible thing. Like, oh my word. Like, I've never seen anything like this. I mean, I have seen miracles. You can read about them on that page, but this is, like, in a whole category by itself. I could have never predicted it. I could have never planned it. You weren't necessarily seeking it out.
No. And in fact, like, that's not even my healing experience the first time. You know, it was just more of a resolve. And so I expected, you know, that I would come to the same sort of resolve in a deeper version the second time, not completely obliterated by laughter. And, yeah, it was really intense. I mean, I think I developed a whole other set of belly muscles just from that time and that season. But, yeah, and then after that, you know, even, like, leading worship, I couldn't get through a set without laughing, you know, and giggling in church, which is probably partly distracting to some other people. But I was, you know, I was having this time with God, and he was really padding and giving me that center back, you know, and it was really powerful, and I was really going to need that, because at the time I really thought, okay, it's probably in response to all the death and all the sorrow and all the grief. I had no idea that a year after that I was going to hit a whole nother bottom and just be completely over it, you know, and it's like, I have that time. Like I went through this year and, you know, recorded an album and kind of just made my story, you know, want to be worth something, and just got really burnt out with all of it and just sort of hit this wall. And then I was done. I was all the way done. I didn't want to talk about anything anymore. I didn't want to like participate in the life of doing church as I knew it. It was just, I was so over life as I knew it. And I wasn't expecting that to happen because I was already healed, right? And so what I had to learn was I had to let go again. So this whole letting go thing has become this thing that it's like I realize it's not something that you do once. You let go as many times as it takes. And every time that you let go, it gives an opportunity for healing. And it brings opportunity to unveil this wholeness that we already are. So I was busy hanging on to this experience, and then I released it, and then I was hanging on to the new experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so it's this whole idea of like clinging and getting attachment. And so now I was attached to this one version in one way that I was healed. And that even, I couldn't even hang on to that because that's not the purpose. It's not the goal. It was a tool. It was a tool to help bring me into the fullness of myself. And so even learning to let that go, it's taught me how to be present. It's taught me how to come into the moment and take each moment for its own thing. It's all valid. Exactly where I am is all valid. It's all real. And it's, I mean, it, of course it's real. It's my life. It's what's happening. But to not cling to the good or the bad, and also to not have aversion towards what's happening, you know, not to put it off to say, oh, but I can't go there because it's already happened. I've already been sad, so I can't go down that road, you know, or to cling to it and say, well, I have to be sad because, you know, you feel this like bound, dutiful, what, you know, ness, if that's not really a word. Yeah.
Being disrespectful.
Right,
too.
Exactly. And there's, you know, there's this bit that it validates our story if we have an emotion, a specific emotion attached to it. So if we're sad, that validates the experience.
Mm.
And if you let go of that sadness, then what happens to that experience? Does it still exist? Is it still anything? Does it matter? But that actually binds us to that thing, you know? And it's not very freeing to be bound to something, regardless of what it is. On the other hand, same thing with the healing thing, you know, to be attached to that one experience. Is that it then? So what happens when I'm not laughing anymore? Does that mean that my healing isn't still there? Does that mean it's not real? Mm. Well, so I have to let go of that because healing can happen in any sort of container, in any sort of, I mean, it doesn't only happen in the weird and the extreme and the out, you know, the outside the box. It can also happen well within the box, well within being conservative, very much in the quiet. It can happen anywhere. So for me, like the key to healing has been the repetitive letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go of all of it. And, you know, I realize that in a way it can sound a little bit stoic, but it's really coming with an attitude of, I just want to experience the fullness of this life. And part of that fullness includes loss, you know, and we all realize that death is part of life, you know, I mean, most of us realize that, we get it, we know that we are having this human experience, regardless of your religious beliefs, pretty much most people know that this human body only lasts for a certain amount of time, right?
Yep. Yep.
It doesn't really matter where you go after this, for the sake of this conversation, you're here right now for your, you know, 70 to 100 years, whatever you're here for, and, to experience that means that you also just, you let things come in through your life, and they're in your life for a while and then they go away. And that includes people, you know, and, you know, for Alex and Jamie, their journey as their human experience didn't last very long. And I can't even put a why on it. I don't think that that's even the question. Like I said before, it's more where's the treasure? For me, the treasure in being in relationship, I was married to Jamie for 9 years and 2 days.
Mm.
And That was a beautiful growing up time. We were really young when we got married. We spent our 20s together, and we got to grow up. We got to grow up together, and part of who I am today gleaned from the experience of our time together, and it was really irreplaceable, and it was special, and we had three beautiful people who wouldn't exist in this human form in this way on this earth without that relationship. And, you know, with Alex, 13 years we got with him. And I wouldn't trade it for anything. But allowing them to have their own experience actually empowers them for their journey. So mm-hmm. for me to get out of the way and say, okay, you know, life is taking over in this way, in this capacity, so I have to let go and I have to let that happen. That is empowering for them for their own personal journey, but also for me to say, okay, so life gets to look a little bit different now. And so now, you know, I mean, we've had another baby, you can see, with, you know, as our fourth child, and now Haley has taken the role of the oldest child. Sam, who was the baby for 7 years, is now the middle child, and now we have a new baby who is, now she's four. And, you know, and it's just like we as a family, we have a really unique dynamic because we get to see those changes happen in our life. And so we realize that we're not clinging to this. Like, Haley is no longer the middle child just by default. So she has stepped into a new place in life and in a new role. I'm married to a whole new person, you know, yes. and he's amazing and wonderful. And I am enjoying this life, and they're just not comparable. So there are these experiences that we get to have. And so relating that to sadness and to grief and also to healing is that they're also experiences, you know. So I get to experience sorrow for whatever it's worth. And it has taught me so much. It's taught me how to love deeper. It has taught me how to be present and to be fully engaged for whatever time I have with people. And I feel like that's sort of a cheeky answer because a lot of people come to that conclusion that experience loss, but it really is because of this experience that we experience that we are able to come back to and say, okay, yeah, I can't take life for granted. I can't take that time. And even though my religious beliefs or my, you know, my background, my philosophical background of thinking, okay, I'm going to see these people again in heaven one day, I will never know them the same way that I've known them on earth. That is unique to its own special time. And so to take that for what it is requires you to be present. It requires you to be fully aware of what's going on and fully in the moment and take it for whatever it is. And so for me, it just became a really easy thing to see that for as much as I put agendas on things, like, I'm actually wasting time because it's not going to turn out like I think it's going to anyway. You know, we've already worked that one out. So I know it's not going to turn out like that. I don't want to waste any time. I want to see things as they are, not as I wish them to be. So if I can see it as it actually is, then I can have the fullness of what's happening. And that's healing in itself, you know? It really is. And, yeah.
You used an analogy earlier before we started about you can hold on to the rock or you can go to the surface, but you can't.
Yeah, so it's like taking, you know, this rock that's sitting at the ocean floor, and you can hold on to it, and you're welcome to hold on to it for as long as you want. I mean, that's your priority, your prerogative. But you cannot hold on to that rock and come up for air at the same time. In order to come up for air, you have to let go of the rock. And, you know, eventually you're going to want to come for air. So, I mean, it's just that whole letting go. And there is goodness on the other side of the letting go. You might not see what it is. You can't see to the surface of the water if you're on the ocean floor. But you know the air is up there, and you know that it's good. And eventually it just becomes necessary, and you can let go. So whether you let go because you are out of curiosity and you want to see what's at the surface, or if you let go out of desperation, like was my experience of, okay, fine, whatever, you're going to do what you want anyway. I don't have anything left. I can't do it anymore. I let go out of exhaustion, out of needing to get air. Either way, the outcome is the same. And in grace, the outcome is still goodness. It's still good. So, yeah, I mean, I think that if there's anything that I can take away from my whole story that I would love to leave with other people is the ability to, because the other thing it's taught me is compassion. I guess I should say this before I say what I think everyone should do.
Sure.
Compassion. It's having compassion for where people are. And it's really easy for us to be able to look at other people's sorrow and other people's grief and sadness and say, oh, well, you know what? You should do this. I mean, I could say that. Well, this is what worked for me, so you should do it. And I'm not saying that there's like a foolproof step-by-step thing that one should do, you know? I think that honoring right where you are validates you. It validates your story. If you're sad, honor the sadness. There is a gift in the sadness that comes. There is a gift in the devastation. It is awareness. It's an opportunity to reveal your heart and where you are. If you're sad, somebody told me once that grief is just a measurement of how deep you've loved. And that was a really special thing to hear. That it was like, of course you're grieving, because you don't grieve something you don't care about. And if you have lost something and you're not grieving, that's not to say that you haven't loved as well. But it's just to say that if you are sad, if you've lost something, and it doesn't have to be death, anything, loss is loss, you know? There isn't one thing that's deeper than the other. Like, I don't have a harder story or a sadder story than the person who has lost their entire life and their job and their money and their spouse and what. It's loss. Loss is loss. So you honor where you are with it. And then you step back and allow yourself to observe the process, like what's happening, what's going on, without judgment. It's not right or wrong. It just is. It's just happening. And you don't identify yourself one way or the other with it. Your experience does not define you. It's not it. You know, it's an experience. So it's like watching it on a movie screen. You know, I feel like my life is one big Lifetime saga movie, you know? And it's just not identifying with it. And it's saying, okay, it's happened. And yes, it's affected me, but it isn't who I am. And then letting it go and releasing it. And so there's no one that can tell you when a good time is to release it. Only you know when you need to come up for air. And every person has that instinct gasping for air ability, you know? You'll know when it's time to let go. If you feel a nudge and you're just being stubborn, then, you know what? Own the stubbornness, because eventually you'll need to come up for air. Wow. And healing is inevitable. It will happen, because we are already whole.
Wow. So, explain a little bit about your album that you made, because that's part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
At least a minute or two.
Yeah, so I recorded an album at the end of 2010, I think. Yeah, it's been a little bit. But it was just a process of my journey through healing. So it's very personal to me. It's slightly worship oriented, because that's, you know, me, part of me as well. It bleeds out of every part of me, so it comes out in the album a bit, but it's also written in a way of, it just sort of unpacks my experience. So there's a song called Dear Love on the album, and I wrote that face down on the bathroom floor in the hospital. And lyrically, it's just, dear love, don't fail me now. It was really my plea and cry to God, in a way of like, our son was in a coma at that time. We didn't know if he would wake up. If he did, we weren't sure if he would ever be the same again. And it was really like my cry and plea to God, like, please don't fail. Please be this light in the darkness. It's so dark. I don't know what to do. Just be here, you know? And, you know, there's another song that really stands out to me on that album, Shaking. And, you know, also not a whole lot of lyrics in any of the songs, really. But in that one as well, it's just, you're shaking everything that can be shaken. And I feel like I, at that time in my life, that everything that I knew to be true is shaken to the core, you know, and I can't make excuses. I can't ever answer why to people. You know, I think that's probably why I've come to the conclusion that it really isn't the right question to be asking, because it was irrelevant. It was just, I was feeling the earth, my world, being shaken all the way down, and everything fell. I mean, there wasn't one single thing that remained. But out of all the ash that was left, I saw beauty in all of it rise up. And then, that, you know, the album is called Hiding Place, and that's the title track to that was the last song, actually, that was written, and it's probably my favorite. It is really such a special song to write, because it was just all-encompassing of speaking to that hiding place that's deep within, and it's where I learned to be still and know. And there's a certain amount of mystery that comes with that. So you have to be able to tolerate the mystery to have that quiet place. And, you know, because when I say I know, it's that peace, you know. It just, it passes every ability to understand. So I don't have to get it. I don't have to be able to articulate it and know to know that it's okay. Like, everything really is as it should be. And so, you know, that whole project kind of was really just coming out of this place of, yeah, I'm in my spot. I found my center. I'm living there. It's quiet, and you know, he's speaking right into that place.
And that's at justsmileymusic.com, right?
Yeah, I don't even think we have that site up anymore, actually. Okay. Yeah, so thank you. It's on iTunes. Yeah, you can get it on iTunes.
All right.
And, you know, I think even the church still sells it.
Okay. And so now you're... Explain what you've been doing for the last year or so.
Yeah, so to make me even more weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've gone from one pendulum, or on the pendulum from one end to the other. I teach meditation and yoga to people, and I love it. I love it. I love it. It's really been a practical tool to help people kind of find their moment and really the expansiveness of what that looks like, and to be able to sit and observe yourself without judgment is the kindest process that you can do. I think it's really how God sees us. And so to be able to have your eyes open to see yourself in that way is really healing in and of itself. I love being able to, I love the holistic side of it, of being able to link the mind and the body and the spirit together, you know, because I think that I've experienced a lot of life where those three things are equally important, but they kind of operate on their own. So we walk around in these bodies with these detached minds, because in our culture we're very, very good at multitasking. So we can be doing something physically with our body and really be engaged in 100,000 other things in the mind. And so this is an activity that causes you to pause and say, wait, we're going to pull all of this together, and you walk out with a full spirit, full heart. You know, and one thing that I've learned from teaching yoga that I've brought into, you know, teaching with, like, whether it's clients or people that I'm talking to or whatever, is really this idea of setting an intention, because that gives you purpose. It gives you the why to what you're doing. So even as you, like, go through, if you're in a season of sadness, you know, set an intention for that season. Like, what is the purpose of it? You know, don't just be sad for the sake of being sad, you know. Get an intention involved, like, okay, I am grieving this. Okay, that means there's going to be movement. You know, it becomes, it makes it so that your life waters aren't stagnant. You know, and then creating a lifestyle that supports that intention for what it is will help, you know, get the most out of life. Because what a waste to go through life, and then what is it all for at the end of your life? You know, you want to have gleaned all the experiences that you can, because you'll take it with you. You know, you can only take who you are and what you've experienced with you. And so if this is a tool that can enable people to experience life fuller, more fully, you know, I'm all for it. So I love it. It's been a really good experience.
Wow. Well, this has been good. This has been really good. So I really appreciate you telling this very vulnerable story.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate, you know, even being able to tell it. It's good.
Yeah, and I appreciate everybody who decided to show up on a Christmas Eve and listen, you know, listen to the story. So, thank you.
Thank you.
So, appreciate everyone. We'll post a recording of this in a little bit, and thanks for spending time today. Take care.